This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering, and it's Friday, which means we take some time to dive beneath the headlines on one of the major stories of the week. And this week, we are going to dig into ballot question 4 with an informal debate. Today's conversation is hosted by WBUR, the Boston Globe, and WCVB. And there are several ways you can follow it. Aside from listening on 90.9 WBUR, we're also broadcasting a video feed of today's event. You could go to WBUR.org, BostonGlobe.com, or WCVB.com to watch that. So here in the studio, representing the yes side of question 4, State Senator Brendan Crighton. Senator, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
And representing the no side of question 4, former State Senator Dean Tran. Dean Tran, welcome to you as well.
Oh, thank you very much for the invitation and happy Friday.
Happy Friday. Viva Van Der Dee. So I'm going to set the table quickly here. Question 4 deals with an existing law that would allow immigrants in Massachusetts who do not have legal status to obtain a driver's license to get one. And that was passed in June, goes into effect next summer. It was passed over Governor Baker's veto. The state legislature overrode it. Again, not yet gone into effect. A yes vote would keep the law on the books and allow people who do not have legal status to obtain a license. A no vote would repeal the law.
Correct.
Okay, so we're going to get started. And I'm going to do this a little differently. I'm going to, having gone through the arguments, we're going to kind of go by categories. We're going to start with safety. Then we're going to go to immigration, and then we're going to go to administration. And I'm going to ask you to try to kind of stay in those buckets with me as we go. So starting with safety, State Senator Crighton, why do you feel this law makes driving safer?
I think this is a common sense law, again, that would require all drivers on the roads to follow the same set of rules. So that means when you're earning a driver's license, you need to take a road test, take a vision test. You need to get insurance. You are earning this driver's license. And again, I drive my kids to school every day, ages 7 and 3. I want to make sure that every other car on that road has gone through the proper channels, has gotten it the right way, has shown documentation, has proven who they are, and that they are insured. So we've seen in 17 other states really big improvements to public safety, less uninsured drivers and less accidents. Again, it was overwhelmingly passed in the legislature. We were able to override the veto. And this is about safer roads. It's something law enforcement has supported, from our DAs to our sheriffs to our major cities chiefs association, which endorsed the law. Those are the folks on the front lines, in terms of public safety, and certainly want to trust in their judgment and support yes on 4 for safer roads.
Okay, Brendan Crighton, correct me if I'm wrong. I think it's 16 states and the District of Columbia.
So 17 have passed. Rhode Island also had passed it, but it's not yet in effect. Hard keeping up. But again, this isn't new. This has been around for 20 years. Massachusetts has got to see how it's worked and been a success in other communities. So certainly not leaders on this. It's time for us to catch up with those other states.
So your response on that safety argument, Dean Tran?
Well, thank you very much for that question. Even though there's 16 states that have passed this existing law that is in the books right now, but it has not been implemented, that doesn't mean that 16 people jump off the bridge and I'm going to jump off the bridge with them. I was a ranking member on the Transportation Committee when I was in the state Senate, and this bill came into light when I was on that committee. I was involved in the debate as well as the discussions and questioning of the bill. That bill did not pass the committee in 2019, but it came out of committee this year. Now, I questioned a lot of people during that time. We had people that been living in this state over 20, 25 years and didn't even speak a word of English. This bill and this law is not about public safety, nor is it about driving. It's about skirting and circumventing the immigration law. And once we proceed further into this debate, I'm going to lay out the grounds to support what I just said.
Okay. But I want to come back to this now, because we will. Mm-hmm.
We'll stay with public safety.
Yeah. So is there some aspect from a public safety standpoint of this law that you see as the equivalent of jumping off a bridge?
Oh, when I was serving in the state Senate, there was absolutely no data to support that passing this law will make the road safe. The argument that the Police Chief Association is supporting this, well, they back when I was in the state Senate, they supported the idea of providing identification. They did not want to get involved with the driving issue.
But now we've seen hit and run data across the states that have implemented it, and it's gone down.
Which data is that?
Harvard University study showing data hit and run accidents have gone down in the 16 states that have implemented.
Mm-hmm. Well, the rate of hit and run may have gone down, but the rate of accidents have gone up.
So what about that?
So that's a trade-off.
First, I just need to correct the record. So it did come out of committee last session as well. So the committee you were on did vote favorably to get out of committee. I would say the data, as you said, it has not been refuted at all to this point. I mean, it's facts. These are hit-and-run accidents. These are also uninsured drivers.
Okay, but I do want to push on that because I will tell you that in looking at that hit-and-run data, my assumption is what's gone down is the run. Is there any data that shows that what's gone down is the hit?
Absolutely not. When I was in the state Senate, there was no data to support this argument that this bill is public safety issue.
All right, so pick it up.
I would say we have law enforcement supporting us for the exact reasons that I just laid out. There is data on that. I understand there is a hit and run component, but look at the uninsured drivers. I mean, accidents across the country have gone up generally, and that's a major issue. But when you look at these 16 states and shortly after they've implemented it, from Connecticut to California, you look at New Mexico and Utah, 80 and 60% decrease in uninsured drivers. That makes safer roads for all of us, and that's why we have the support from law enforcement. We had the support because we worked closely with them to build this law.
Let me touch on the point that the senator mentioned about the law enforcement support of this bill. Now, granted that you have the Police Chief Association supporting this in terms of having identification, but the police unions do not support this. So let's make that clear.
I mean, which unions are you talking about? Local police departments? I am unaware. When we've had hearings on this bill, we have not had opposition come out from law enforcement. So I'm curious who.
Well, my time in the state senate when I spoke to
enforcement. You've been out of the senate for a while. Which groups are not supporting this?
Which unions have taken a vote?
Then we're going to put a pause in this. So what we can stipulate at this moment is that we know, for example, the State Association of Chiefs of Police does support this.
So the major city chiefs, just to be clear and fair.
Yeah, thank you. Yep. The major city chiefs, which is cities over 40,000. Dean Tran, you are arguing that there are local unions, but not naming those unions. We're back on safety here. Identification comes up in the immigration section of this.
But we have to make sure, we have to make sure and identify what components of this bill that the Police Chief Association support.
They support the entire law.
They support the identification law. Part of the bill.
No, they support the law. They're on record. They have voted unanimously, and I was there at the table with them. Unanimously, they were crucial to getting this bill a compromise, which you don't hear that often in government, but a compromise has worked. They have give their full support to our bill.
So I'm going to put a pin in that one, and we're going to come back to safety for just a minute. I'm going to ask two additional questions. First, Brendan Crichton, you've said, so Dean Tran said accidents have gone up. I said, what about the hit side? You said, well, accidents have gone up across the board. Are you aware of data either way that indicates whether the increase in accidents in the last few years correlate in the 16 states that have passed this law and implemented it, correlate with the increase in drivers on the road through increased driver's license access?
Unfortunately, there's serious accidents across the country in all states. So if you want to point to accident data, you know, it varies state to state. There's no correlation whatsoever with states that have passed it that accidents have increased. In fact, they've decreased, and that's what we've seen. So there is data there. The mass budget, as well as you referenced the Harvard study. Believe me, we've been working on this for quite some time. We've looked for holes in our arguments. We can't find any data, nor will any states say that this has gone the bad way. Otherwise, it would.
So, Dean Tran, the ID and licensing, the ID piece aside, do you take issue with the idea that drivers who have been tested, are insured, and have been certified as licensed drivers would increase safety on the roads versus people driving without testing, certification, and licensure?
Look, I have no issue with if you're an American citizen in this country and if you're of legal age to be licensed. Then of course you can go through all the course of achieving the driver's license, but now go back to the data that we're talking about. Just because we have some data that has shown that hit and run rates have gone down, it doesn't necessarily correlate to illegal immigrants getting driver's license.
Okay, so I'm gonna reset us here. You're listening to a debate on ballot question 4, one of 4 ballot questions that Massachusetts voters will weigh in on in this election cycle. Question 4 deals with an existing law that would allow immigrants in Massachusetts who do not have legal status to obtain a driver's license. And to be clear, a yes vote would keep the law on the books and allow those folks to get a license. A no vote on question 4 would repeal the law. Here with us representing the yes side is State Senator Brendan Crighton, and representing the no side is former State Senator Dean Tran. Our conversation is brought to you by WBUR, the Boston Globe, and WCVB. And in addition to listening here on WBUR 90.9 FM, you can watch a video stream, WBUR.org, BostonGlobe.com, or WCVB.com carry that. So now we are going to move into the question of immigration in this law, all right? There are some questions about immigration, authority, legitimacy at play here. Senator Crighton, one of the arguments that the no side has made is that allowing folks who are here but who do not have legal status to obtain a license legitimizes their presence here. What is your response to that?
So this bill has nothing to do with immigration. I appreciate you raising it as a topic, but I will say that here in Massachusetts, in the state legislature, and our voters will have a chance to vote as well, not on immigration policy. That is a federal matter. That is for Congress. I will not dispute that we've had a broken immigration system for most of my lifetime, if not all of it. We don't have control over that here. What we do have control over is making our roads safe for everybody. And again, that's why we worked with law enforcement to fine-tune the documentation, as well as the steps to get folks registered, to get them, you know, having taken a test, having gotten insurance. Again, this is a public safety issue. This is not an immigration issue. We don't have authority over it.
Let me just stay with you, and then I'm going to come back to the authority thing, but I'm going to stay with you for a second. So this week, Evan Horowitz, who's the executive director of the Center for State Policy Analysis at the Tisch College of Civic Life at Tufts, produced a report on question 4. It was a pretty down-the-line analysis, right? I would argue a pretty nonpartisan report. And he did raise the fact that whether formal or informal, there is a sense that providing licensure, driver's licenses, does confer some level of legitimacy. So that's an independent report. Your response to that?
I mean, it's the legitimacy argument doesn't matter. Folks are interested in coming to Massachusetts. It's because of our institutions of higher education, our workforce opportunities, because it's a beautiful place to raise a family. Again, having a license gives you the ability to drive a car. You have proven, you have earned that. It has nothing to do with your citizenship status. It already doesn't. We have plenty of folks that aren't citizens here in the Commonwealth, whether green card holders, DACA recipients, TPS recipients, visa, you know, work visas, student visas. They all can drive a car because they can all earn a license. Because it has nothing to do with your citizenship.
All right. So, Dean Tran, I'm going to turn to you. I'm going to pick up this thread of the purview of the federal government around immigration status versus purviews of the state government. One of the arguments that the no side, which you represent, has raised is the state just doesn't have legal authority to do this because it affects immigration status. Brendan Crighton has just said it doesn't. It's just about driving a car. Your response.
Look, there's one thing that we, all three of us, agree on is that immigration law is a federal issue. But this law here, allowing driver's license to illegal immigrants is a way to skirt and circumvent the federal immigration law. Now we have something in place in the books, and it's the MGL Chapter 90. And most of us know that Chapter 90 is about funding roads and bridges and so forth. But there are other provisions within Chapter 90 that address this. And Section 8 of Chapter 90. One of the things that it says is that no license of any type may be issued to any person who does not have lawful presence in the United States.
So what
now,
about that, Brendan?
Now, let me continue on that part. Now, the legislature took it upon it themselves and completely rewrote that section and added language that would...
I'll give you a response. Yeah, go ahead.
And then we placed it with, shall be eligible for Massachusetts license to operate a motor vehicle as long as they provide satisfactory proof of registrar of their identity, date of birth, and Massachusetts residency. Now, that proof can be anything. There's a list full of things, including a marriage certificate, a divorce decree.
One has to have a picture, consular ID, or passport. That's not anything. Those are pretty solid IDs.
But here's to the point again. If this is just about public safety and if it's just about driving, then let's make it so. Let's make it so. Let's make a distinction between the licenses. One of the things that I don't know about you, but my license, I have an M on it. That would signify that I ride a motorcycle. I have a heart that signifies that I'm a donor. Let's make a distinction with the driver's license. And the legislature denied an amendment to do so.
Okay, let's turn back to Brendan.
So, I mean, I have to correct the facts, and you already did to a certain degree. Obviously, we worked with law enforcement to find the the strongest possible documentation. So that'd be a passport or a consular ID and additional documentation, which he needs. So it's just not accurate to say there, you know, it's not stringent. It's as stringent as you can be. And law enforcement, who we worked with, believe so, and I trust their judgment.
I do want to clarify for listeners that also the law states no access to a real ID, which is the one that's coming at the federal level.
So in Massachusetts, that's a great point. In Massachusetts, we have two forms of ID. We have a real ID, which would allow you to get in federal buildings as well as to fly on a plane, and we have a standard driver's license. Many folks just choose to get the standard. We would just simply allow folks without legal status to earn a standard driver's license. There's no need to make any indications otherwise. They are able to drive. That is what a standard driver's license gives you the ability to do.
But also in Massachusetts, you do not need a real ID in order to register to vote, as well as you don't need a real ID to get access to all the benefits afforded to all the American citizens. Now, all you need is a driver's license in the state.
Okay, so
Can I rebuttal on that, please?
Yes, but let me comb this out clear what you're rebutting.
Yep.
So part of your argument is that in Massachusetts, one does not need a real ID to access services. Any driver's license will do. Is that what you said?
Yes, that's what I said.
Now, is that what you want to rebut?
I wanted to rebut the voting piece, but also that. So I would say that...
and then we'll do the voting piece.
So this gives you no additional benefits. Your ID does not get you access to benefits. It doesn't give you access to citizenship, and it doesn't allow you to vote. You have to be a citizen of 18 years to register to vote. And this, I will agree with this point that you don't need a real ID to register to vote. You do not need a driver's license to register to vote. So it's a moot argument.
Voter registration then moves us into, I'm mindful of time, and so I'm running a little roughshod here. We're having a conversation about question four, which has to do with access to driver's license for people without legal status. State Senator Brendan Crighton is on the yes side, which would keep the law in place. Former State Senator Dean Tran is on the no side, which would revoke the law. We're going to move into administration here, because this question of voter ID seems to hinge on both sides over whether the RMD can effectively keep people from automatically being registered to vote if they obtain a driver's license. Is that the argument on the no side, Dean Tran?
Oh, absolutely. That's part of the argument. And that is, you know, the RMD is a debacle right now. Unless it has changed since the last 2 years that I left the Senate, they do not have the resources, nor do they have the expertise to do this or implement this law. Unless things has changed in the last 2 years, I know that if you acquired a license to drive or renew your license, you have an option to register to vote. Now, why not build a law that says, okay, let's just make this driving only? But the legislature did not do that because they want to provide a way.
No, the law says that you specifically can't, that just does not qualify you to register to vote. That's what the law says.
But currently at the RMV, when you get your license, you're automatically registered to vote.
All right, let's
you have to opt out.
Less than a minute
I'll try to go quick. So that's not true. Automatic voter registration is a bit of a misnomer, so I can understand why people would misunderstand it. You are not automatically registered to vote when you get a driver's license. They check to see if you are a citizen first. They do the same at MassHealth. This argument from their side has been debunked again and again and again. We already have many non-citizens, DACA recipients, TPS, green card holders, et cetera, that already have driver's licenses, yet they are not registered to vote because there is a safeguard system already in place.
Okay, so we're going to stop there, and I'm going to give you like two sentences each. Dean Tran, you first. Summarize your argument, 2 to 3 sentences.
First of all, this is not a public safety issue, nor is it a driving issue. It's about skirting the immigration law, allowing people to vote and having access to the benefits that the American citizens have. This cost, it currently costs the state of Massachusetts $2.5 billion to provide benefits to illegal immigrants, and this is going to make it worse.
Okay.
That's just a hateful thing to say and really disrespectful. It's not true. This has nothing to do with benefits. It has nothing to do with voting. It has nothing to do with citizenship. It has to do with safer roads. And when families are out on the road, they should know that every other driver has earned a driver's license, has shown documentation, has passed a road test, and has gotten insurance. It's for safer roads. and it's supported by law enforcement.
Let's just driving.
And that concludes our debate on question four. Thanks to State Senator Brendan Crichton and former State Senator Dean Tran for joining us. Thanks to both of you. Today's debate was brought to you by WBUR, the Boston Globe, and WCVB. And you can watch today's entire conversation on our website at radioboston.org. Next week, we will bring you a debate on ballot question one, also known as the millionaire's tax. And don't forget to vote on Tuesday, November 8th. Gentlemen, thank you again for today. Boston Fashion Week kicks off tomorrow, and by reputation, the Boston fashion scene has to give the nod to New York for preeminence, but that could change because fashion is going digital. That's right, clothes you wear online, either along with or, get this, instead of in real life. And as we know, when it comes to tech, the business of Boston has skills. WBUR business reporter Yasmeen Ammer joins us now to talk about this. Welcome back, Yasmeen.
Thank you so much, Tiziana. It's so nice to be here talking about fashion.
There we go. So I want to start with defining. I mean, it kind of bent my brain. So what is digital fashion?
So it's kind of what it sounds. It's clothes made of pixels, clothes on the screen. But what's interesting about digital fashion is it can serve so many different purposes. So since the pandemic, a lot of companies have been using digital fashion to render 3D models, and it makes it much easier to make in real life. The software is getting good. And so a lot of these clothes will be made in the real world. But what I was interested in and what I wanted to do with this story is kind of dive in to the digital fashion that is meant to exist solely in the digital space. Like, why would anybody want this? Why would anybody buy this?
So why would anybody want this? Well, why would anybody buy this?
I mean, it's an interesting question. And digital fashion serves so many different purposes. Fashion is a form of expression. It's self-expression. And I actually want to share a little bit of a story that I think illustrates the purpose, and that has to do with my youngest brother. We are 12 years apart, and there is nowhere where that is more apparent than in the way we use the internet. And I remember him years ago buying a $30 digital hat, and I remember looking at him saying, "Are you nuts? Why would you? This is a scam. Why would anybody spend money on this?"
To be clear, a hat that doesn't exist in real life.
No, it just exists on a game. And shout out to gamers, because they've known this for years. They've been buying fashion on games for a while. But the point is, self-expression for him extends into the virtual world. It's not just about buying an actual hat for him. That was special. That was a gathering spot for him. So there is meaning in digital fashion. And I think what's different about this moment and why I chose to report this is that big companies are taking notice.
Like
here in Boston, Puma, which is headquartered here, and New Balance are looking into this. Also, legacy companies, Gucci, Prada, all these luxury companies, and the one that I interviewed, I was interested in the startup called Endstate, which is another apparel company.
All right, so we'll come back to Endstate. I want to stretch out on this and have some fun. So I'm going to bring in a second voice that we have here in the studio, Michael Spiker. Michael is a philosopher and the founder of the Boston-based Aesthetics Research Lab, which is a company that examines all the ways that aesthetics impact our lives. And he's got a lot to say about where digital fashion is headed and why. Michael, thanks to you for joining us, too.
Thank you so much for having me.
So when was the first time you ever heard of somebody buying fashion digitally, something that only existed in the digital world?
Just from the world of video games, because people have been immersed in video games even before video games came to exist online. I remember playing games that were not connected to the internet, and even then you could switch the clothing of a character. So that's really the main reason. But where for me, digital fashion came to my kind of recollection with just the idea of digital objects in general. I remember hearing about a court case in the Netherlands where two older boys threatened a younger boy, and what they were after was for him to log into the video game RuneScape and drop two items, and then one of the older boys logged in and picked up those items.
So sort of like Give Me Your Shoes, but in the virtual world.
Yeah. And so if we care this much about virtual objects enough to two people to attack a younger boy, and the Supreme Court of the Netherlands ruled that a robbery had taken place, not just an assault. So clearly there's some value in the digital assets and objects that that we need to start paying attention to.
So we're talking with Michael Spiker, who is a philosopher and the founder of Boston-based Aesthetics Research Lab. And we're talking with WBUR business reporter Yasmeen Ammer on the business of Boston and digital fashion. And Yasmeen, so let's do the shoe thing now. So now you've found this Boston-based company that has recognized, not, I mean, we've known for decades, ever since Michael Jordan, basically, the value of a fantastic pair of shoes in real life. Sneakers especially. But now we've got the both and.
Yeah. I mean, so what's interesting about Endstate, like I mentioned, all these legacy brands, like Nike's actually really ahead of this game and a lot of the apparel brands where they're making digital fashion. But Endstate, what's interesting about Endstate is it's a native tech company. So they kind of were brought up, they started in 2021. And they already had this digital thing in mind. It's not like we're going to make physical sneakers and then we're going to think about tech down the line. No, this is an important part of their business model. I talked to Stephanie Howard, who's one of the co-founders. She's a shoe designer, worked for the who's who of apparel. And, you know, when you have a physical shoe, you can scan it and there's a chip and it gives you the virtual pair of shoes. And so I kind of want you to just listen to Stephanie Howard about how she sees this.
We believe that all products of value in the future will have a digital counterpart because that digital counterpart has many, many things that it can provide to you as a customer.
So yeah, she's thinking when people buy a piece of apparel, especially a luxury piece of apparel, these sneakers could cost you hundreds of dollars. They're expecting more than just a pair of sneakers. They're expecting an experience. And so when, like, the digital pair of sneakers is kind of a ticket to real life events. So I can tell you, like, a group of them, the people who bought the sneakers are going to be, like, at the Boston College football game all together tomorrow, for example. They're gathering. So part of it is a community aspect. Like, you have this virtual shoe, so it's your ticket to certain places. But also, she's planning for the future, a future where these virtual spaces get so much more immersive that we're going to essentially take our fashion with us. Our fashion in the real world is going to translate to what we wear in the metaverse.
So, Michael, that's the thing, right? You're nodding vigorously about as we move more into our digital world. Talk some more about that.
Yeah, the future, people project the future of the internet is 3D. And if you're there in a 3D space, you're going to want to adorn yourself with clothing, hairstyles, handbags,
just
accessories.
Just like I do in this 3D space, where I thought about what I was going to wear this morning and how I was going to do my hair, etc.
Exactly. And especially, you know, with the pandemic and everyone jumped online all of a sudden, even there are filters that you can add to Zoom where you're wearing something that you aren't actually wearing. So that's one usage of it. But as you create your own avatar and start existing in the metaverse, which is, you know, coming at some point, you're going to want to wear something.
So let me stay with you for a minute because I'm going to lean into your philosopheriness for a second. Why do I feel profoundly intrigued and profoundly uncomfortable about that?
Well, you probably feel uncomfortable if you have seen any of the movies, especially from the 90s, like The Matrix, where the virtual space was a bad thing. So for me, this is where my interest lies as a philosopher is, you know, philosophers are perennially concerned with the nature of reality. And one of the other topics for me personally is aesthetics and beauty. And to keep and retain our humanity in virtual spaces, we need to start asking about these things now instead of waiting till it already happened and then start worrying about, well, how do we get here? So that's where my interest lies in moving forward with some of these thoughts.
So we're talking about the world of digital fashion, which sometimes is a both and, physical fashion and digital fashion, and sometimes is just digital, just online. We've just heard from Michael Spiker of Aesthetics Research Lab. Turning back to Yasmeen Ammer, the business reporter for WBUR. So what are the questions that Boston businesses are asking as they start to think about this world and where it's going?
So the number one question, I think, is what is the new technology and how fast are we going to get there? Because I think a lot of how widespread this becomes, like if you and I all of a sudden decide that we need like virtual suits right now, might depend on the fact that like, are we actually gathering in these spaces and are we gathering in these spaces? Like, is this where I have community? Like, can we attend like a virtual conference that feels lifelike? Can we attend a concert? Like, are we going to be doing these things? And is a technology good enough to, like, actually make us want to get there? So I think that's number one. And I think also one of the interesting things that I learned is a lot of people are making this really environmental argument for digital fashion. Like, could we possibly, you know, even replace fast fashion? Like, who knows? Like,
wait, what's fast fashion?
So fast fashion are these cheap, trendy clothes. Like, sometimes they're sold online. I don't know, like a $10 pair of shorts. And they're, you know, terrible for the environment usually because it's just you're cranking out a bunch of cheap clothes. And people could buy them to wear, like, to wear for one online picture. And so maybe some companies are already selling you digital fashion you can superimpose on, like, your Instagram pic. And I've seen that. And so maybe, just maybe, if the technology gets good enough and this gets mainstream enough, would people choose to wear digital fashion rather than, like, a bunch of cheap, trendy clothes? And is that a better environmentally friendly way to do it? I don't know. And plus, this is also good for Boston because, I mean, obviously tech is, like, where we shine. So some companies and designers are looking into this, but, you know, Boston fashion's going to be nerdy. It's already kind of nerdy, and it's just going to get nerdier.
I'm down for that. So, yes. Michael Spiker, turning back to you, philosophically, right, as we think about who we are and who we want to be, mm-hmm. what's the big question for you that digital fashion is posing? What are you noodling on?
For me, it has to do with meaning and aesthetics, because clothing is all about imitating and differentiating. And so you can do that to a greater degree in the digital world because you can create clothing out of things that aren't possible. So somebody's already created sneakers that are on fire, which you obviously can't wear in
can't
the physical
do in real
world.
Life. So how are we going to bridge that?
I think... how are we going to bridge that? That's a good question.
No, I mean, so you're asking how we're going to
bridge
that.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Sorry.
No, that's okay. And I'm afraid, I'm sorry, but our clock is running out. I'm going to stop us there. Michael Spiker is the founder of Boston-based Aesthetics Research Lab. Yasmin Ammer is WBUR business reporter, digital fashion in the business of Boston. Thank you to both of you.
Thank you so much.
And now to WBUR City Space, where last night I spoke with Swiss artist and activist Dan Asher. His world-renowned exhibit, Borealis, made its U.S. debut last night at the Cambridge Science Festival. It runs through Sunday. So wait, how can he bring the Northern Lights to Kendall Square, you ask?
Basically, I'm able to recreate something that looks like the Northern Lights, so it's definitely not the real Northern Lights. I'm not recreating the same process. But I'm creating in the sky. It's not like really, really way high like you would think, but I guess it's above your head, you know. I'm creating lines of lights, but these are invisible to the eye. So basically, you're just there. If we don't turn on the rest of the machine, you just don't see them. And then I'm able to putting different machines around the fields, which create a type of haze. And when this haze moves with the wind and moves around the space, when this haze crosses these lines of lights, that's when the effect appears. And that's what's really interesting for me is that this is an installation about the Northern Lights, which is a natural phenomenon, but this is a person actually creating it.
Okay, so that was the how, but why?
I'm really interested in what makes us human and these moments that trigger an effect within us where there's before and after. So through my research of these moments where you feel really small and where you feel like you belong to something that is bigger than you, speaking with people that had the opportunity to see the real Northern Lights, they really say it's something that has transformed them. You know, it was like just this expanse is really something really special. And I was like, wow, this is really interesting. There's very few things in your life now that have this effect. But then my head works in really weird ways. So the next question in my head was like, okay, but what's the percentage of the world population which will have the opportunity to see this in their life? And it's like, you know, close to nothing because, you know, you can spend 4,000 US dollars to go to Northern Norway and be there at the wrong time and not see them. So then my next question is like, am I able to create something that looks like it and bring it to the people all around the world on big city spaces?
As we chatted about his installation, an audience member asked Asher, why are so many people attracted to the Northern Lights?
Because it's magical. It shouldn't be there. You can't comprehend it. You know, the images that you see makes you wonder how it is possible. So there's this magic. And when you ask people what are the top 10 things they want to do in their lives, most of the time there's seeing the Northern Lights. And again, me being able to recreate it and something that looks like it and bring it to the people is huge. We just did it in Marseille in south of France, and there was 39,000 people over 3 days. And there were families and all the social strats of people and everybody coming together and experiencing this together. And it was very, very strong. And people said, I probably will never be able to go, all the way up north to see them, the right ones, but at least I've seen this. That's really special to me.
So do you believe in magic? Do you think there's magic in the world?
I think magic's going to save us, yeah.
So talk about that.
Okay, there's magic, which can be a trick, but there's magic, which is what happens between us. And this is, again, going back to the essence of what I do. I'm trying to create situations where strangers come together and connect beyond their differences. So in this piece, Borealis, basically people come, there's an invitation, come and, see the Northern Lights. So they go, oh, it's really exciting and stuff. But basically you're here and you'll be all sharing the same emotion and whatever, especially here at the moment, your political stance or your beliefs, your age, all of this is put to the side and you're just there sharing these experiences. A lot of different installations, there's always this thing at the back. So to get people to come together and share the experiences together, this is where magic occurs.
Later in our conversation, we dove deep into another of Swiss artist Dan Asher's installations, and he ultimately put himself and many in the City Space audience into tears.
So this is a project 8 years in the making. It took 8 years to do it. This is in Rennes, which is western France, and this is in front of the government building for the whole region. There's a lot to say about this, and the images go quite quick. But basically,
that's okay. We're going to show it again.
Sure. What we're seeing is an installation. And these are 3.5 meters letters that spell the word secrets, plural, S-E-C-R-E-T-S. And they put into a circle, and we invite the population to walk into this circle. And when they get to the center, there are some notes that say, "This is my secret. Let's burn it together." So we invite people to come and free themselves of a secret, something light, something heavy, doesn't matter, and it has to be anonymous. And when you get into the space, you can either write your secret and pin it to the sides of the letters yourself, or you can put them into a letterbox and my team will come and pin it for you, or you can put it in a black box, which stays sealed till the end of the project. And over 5 days, we invite people to come and free themselves of a secret. So some people know about the installation and come and they know exactly what they want to, free themselves of and put it up. Some of the people have no idea that it's there and just happen and go like, oh, what is this? And they go, oh my God, okay, and it downs on them. And you can either free yourself of a secret, just being made aware of the humanity that surrounds you every day, because that's what really came out was, I had no idea there's all this around me every single day. We're all carrying secrets and, big and small, but we all have our own secrets. And this was a way at the city level to get this to emerge and to come to light. And over 5 days, it just gathers more and more and more. There was no spaces that you could, pin your secrets anymore on the letters. And on the last day, we all come together and we set the whole installation on fire. And again, it's an idea that you have and you wonder how, it's going to work. How people are going to do it. Is the invitation correct? And 25,000 people came through the installation. We had 4,500 secrets and about 4,000 people came for the end of the process for the burn itself.
Did you write a secret?
So I had a secret that I wanted to share. But just holding the space was just so intense that I didn't need to do that anymore.
It kind of burned your secret for you, just doing the installation.
It's just that it lost its weight because there was, so much around me. And again, people come and when you get there and you read the other secrets, you think like, oh, my secret is really special. But then you go like, oh, maybe I'm not alone. And some people come and say, oh, I don't have a secret, you know, what is this? And then they really say, maybe there is something there. And I expected, you know, to the space to be very quiet, but actually it was quite lively. You know, people would come and go like, and you go, oh, come and read this one. There were quite a lot of secrets that were really funny as well. And you go, oh, read this and read this. And some, and the youth really took over, and we thought it would be more elder people, and but actually it was the 18 to 25 years old that really took over. And it's not through social media, because you couldn't take pictures, you couldn't take videos. And so they would come, they go, oh, look, this, and then you see one of them going around and like and writing the secrets, and bang. Oh, they go, then they go, and then two of them would come back and free themselves of the secrets.
Any secrets that particularly stuck with you that you still remember?
Yeah, so a funny one is, I mean, funny. One is saying, like, I'm a doctor, and I cheated in all my exams.
Okay.
I mean, there's somewhere light, somewhere much heavier.
Yeah.
You know, abuse and all that. So we would move them this further up so that the kids, you know, couldn't read them. But there was one that it really touched us. It's basically the installation would open at 9 in the morning, and there was a man in his 50s waiting there for the installation to open, and there was no one else. So we just opened the first gate, and he just walked straight there, took a piece of paper, wrote it, put it in a box, and then went away. And obviously, he was the only one and the first one, so we knew exactly, you know, whose secret it was. So we took it out, and it said, tonight, I'm telling my wife I'm gay. Mm. And you go, wow, you know, like that person waited and found this opportunity and understood that this was the right time for him to do this. And actually, one morning we arrived, and there was a secret that was just thrown in the middle, because this installation was closed, and the guardian said that it was a man in his 60s, bold, that came and just threw it. And he was, I'm really scared. And there was so much stuff about not being loved or loving someone that, you know, not returned. There was cheating, in all types of cheating, okay? I mean, basically on each letter, you had the whole array of the human experience, everything.
When I first heard the concept before I saw, my first worry, my first thought was, this could be so voyeuristic. But it's so clear when you watch it, when you see it, that it's not, it's community. It's not voyeurism. It's not, I'm titillated by your secret. It's, I'm sharing my secret and I'm touched by yours. And one of our audience members says, freeing people of secrets seems like another form of bringing people together, community. Could you explain why community is so important to your work?
So this is very correct. So basically, you know, like in a romantic way of looking at the past, we used to have these rituals throughout the year that would get us to come together and that would have, you know, give us a meaning to our lives and the changing of time. And there were institutions like church here or in a different institution around the world that we would come together and we'd discuss things and understand and give meaning again to what was happening in society. And this is something we have lost in many places. But we need these rituals to be able to come together and have this sense of belonging and this sense of community. So this is a city ritual. And when for the burn, there was kind of real like a ritual. So it was really important that the builders were there, the ones that started to, you know, tear down the letters. That
for the burn.
People, for the burn. The people that were there to hold space, they were the ones set around the installations to be witness of the end of the process. And for them, that was really important, because I can't tell you all the things that came out in the team throughout these days. And then we walked around it, and we had this box, and we were working slowly, and we had the lights on that we turn on and we turn off at the end and put it in the middle, and then someone comes and light it up, and it's all in silence, and people are all around it watching it. And someone that came and this woman that I met, she wrote about abuse happening in a camp, youth camp happening when she was a kid, and she came and she said, I waited 40 years for this. I want to cry, sorry.
That's okay.
Yeah, it was really, really powerful. And I think, again, we just want to feel like we belong, you know, and we're all carrying our own trauma. You know, we all have our own things that we carry with us. And If you're lucky, you know, like basically you can experience this if you go to Burning Man in the middle of the desert, but you know, you have to spend thousands to get there. And you know, it's again, it's the people who have the opportunity and the privilege to be able to go there. But what if we bring this to the middle of the city, to people like you and me, you know, to the everyday people? And that's what is needed more than ever. And it's the type of discussions that you can have if you can afford to go see a psychiatrist, you know, or if you can go on a retreat and do inner looking and, you know, search. But again, what if we could bring this to the city?
And all those experiences, all those examples you just gave are isolated. They're precious. They're curated, right? It is, I go to Burning Man, but everybody else there also wants to be at Burning Man. And then we leave and we all go back to our communities. I go to my therapist's office and we're in a protected space. And then I leave and I go back to my community. Part of what's remarkable about this is the community. That this is an experience that you're having where you don't take yourself out of your everyday community. It's being shared in.
Exactly. And it's also very important that it's right in the center of the city. That means that there's all these people that had no idea about the installation that just happened onto it. And they just go, my God. And then they come back and then the numbers would go up every day because people would speak about it. And actually, the whole work started a month early, with these notes being present in different places around the city and this discussion, okay, what is a secret? Are you carrying a secret? You know, what does it mean carrying a secret? So there's this rumor and this, you know, this discussion starting and goes up until finally the installation is there and the process. So there's an individual process where you either go like, okay, what is my secret or why do I want to show and to free myself off. And so there's the journey to go to the installation, to walk in, to take the piece of paper, to write it and to pin it. And then there's the journey of watching other people coming and be seen, finally be seen of what we have inside. And then there's the communal aspect with the catartic moment where we all come together and we set the whole thing on fire.
Swiss artist and activist Dan Asher. We spoke at WBUR City Space last night just before his installation, Borealis, made its U.S. debut at the Cambridge Science Festival. You can catch Borealis for free in Kendall Square starting at 8 p.m. through October 9th. And that's our show for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. I'm Tiziana Dearing. Thanks for listening. Join us again Monday for a special hour of Radio Boston on Indigenous Peoples Day.